Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Oh, well, good morning. You are listening to Science Mixtape on Soho Radio, and it is a beautiful day here in London. It really feels like summer has finally arrived. There's been a lot of talks about diets and getting your summer beach body ready. But today, we are going to be exploring something else that can also affect your weight. Yes, there's a lot of new research showing we are not the only ones in charge of our bodies. In fact, there are trillions of microbes living in our gut, which also play a part. Our gut bacteria. Joining me today is Alana Collin, author of 10% Human, who is an expert in all things microbiome. Good morning, Alana. Thank you for joining me. So 10% Human is the title of your book. What does that mean? Tell me a bit about that.
So that title originally came from the fact that only 10% of the cells in the human body are human cells. The other 90% are bacterial cells or microbial cells, mostly living in your gut. Mostly bacteria. Actually, there's been some new science since that suggests it's a bit more like 50-50, but the title stuck because it's been out for a while.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, you think your gut is just like, feels like a really small part of your body, but...
Yeah, of course, they're way smaller than human cells, most of the bacteria that we keep in us.
Mm. So we are going to be talking more about that in the show. We're going to be looking at how our gut bacteria affect us, and it's more than just our weight, and also how our lifestyle affects which types of bacteria are living in our gut. We will also be making some fermented ketchup. So if you want to take part at home, yes, I know it doesn't sound like an experiment, it's a bit tenuous this week, but you know, food is also quite sciencey. You need quite a lot of things. So you need some tomato puree, you need an airtight container, like a sort of clip one, you need some garlic, salt, pepper, honey, apple vinegar cider, I can't even speak, apple cider vinegar, that's the one, and a little bit of sauerkraut. So there you go. Grab all of those, and we'll be doing that later in the show. But of course, we want to hear from you as always. You could tweet us at Soho Radio with any questions. And our question for you this week is, what one type of food do you think we should eat more of to help grow a healthy gut? So that's what one type of food should you be eating more of to help grow a healthy gut? And you can tweet us at Soho Radio. But now, Alana, you have chosen all the songs this week. What do you want to kick off with?
I think our first song is Sebastian Tellier's La Ritournelle, which is a song that's always meant a lot to me, and I ended up walking down the aisle to it, so I particularly love it now.
Gut is the tropical rainforest of your body. At least in terms of bacterial diversity, there are more than 500 types of microbe.
That's a lot.
It is, yeah.
And so I think a lot of people, when they think about gut bacteria, where you talk about having your good, your healthy gut bacteria, visualising adverts about Yakult, telling me I need to drink my probiotics. But it's a lot more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, those adverts really underplay what microbes do for you. So not particularly the ones in Yakult, but generally speaking, you have between 500 and 1,000 species of microbes living in your gut. And they do all sorts of things. Basically, they communicate with your immune system, and everything runs through that communication. So on the one hand, they're telling your body how much fat to store. They're converting your food into usable vitamins for your body. They're also telling your brain what to do, amazingly enough.
Really?
So they're involved in depression, anxiety, all sorts of mental health problems. And they affect your tendency towards allergies and autoimmune diseases as well.
So let's unpick some of that. You say they're communicating with our immune system. Do we have any idea how they're doing that?
Mostly through little chemical passwords. So your immune system is really centered on your gut as well, because it's actually the outside world as far as your body's concerned.
Yeah, that's true.
You're putting so much into your
and opening
your mouth.
At your top and exactly. An opening it in your bum. Yeah, and it's just a long tube in
yeah,
between.
We
isn't
are
it?
Just a tube like a worm, but with you know arms and legs. so that the exposure that you get through your gut is huge. So your immune system needs to be there to judge what to worry about, what not to worry about, what's a threat.
And I'm guessing things can cross that gut wall and get across that barrier.
They can, and the makeup of the bacteria that you have in your gut controls just how much they can do that as well. So your bacteria are releasing all these compounds into the intestines, which then inform the immune system what's there and what they're doing, and that then translates to all sorts of things around your body, including to your brain.
And how did you first kind of get involved in looking at this?
Well, I'm an evolutionary biologist by training, and I once spent a long time, I used to be a bat scientist actually, and I spent a long time in the jungle in Malaysia, and I got bitten by a lot of ticks, and then I fell very ill. And it took a while to get a diagnosis, but at one point I was diagnosed with Lyme disease, and I was given a lot of antibiotics to try and treat that over quite a long period of time. And that was fine, and it helped, and I got a bit better. But I started to notice all these new symptoms that I hadn't had before. This is when I was about 28.
What kind of symptoms
were
those?
So I started to get hay fever for the first time at that age. I got acne really badly, and I started to get all these minor infections that I'd never really suffered from before. And I started to think, what have I done differently now that I wasn't doing before? And I wondered whether maybe these antibiotics had affected the good bacteria, and that's all I knew about them, just good bacteria, yeah, in a kind of Yakult sense. And as I looked into it, being a scientist, of course, I looked straight at the scientific literature, and discovered that there was this whole world of things that people were linking to microbes in your gut, and that indeed my hay fever could be a consequence of the antibiotics as well. And that really got me interested. I already wanted to write a book, so I just started researching more and more and then pulled it together.
Wow. So your hay fever could have developed because you changed the guts, the bacteria in your gut, because the antibiotics
possible.
Killed them.
Yeah, it's possible, yeah.
That's crazy. Mm. And I know that you've told me there's a lot about how it affects our weight. It's telling our body how much fat to store. Mm-hmm. How did they first discover that link?
Well, I think the first thing that happened was a guy suddenly started to wonder, why have we never tested what impact it has to have all these microbes in the guts? Mm. So they took a bunch of germ-free mice. So these are mice that are born by C-section, so they get no microbes. It's all done very sterilely. And then they're kept in isolation. And so they have no bacteria whatsoever in their guts. And then they just tried giving them some bacteria, a normal set of mouse bacteria. And within 2 weeks, they'd put on 60% more fat on their bodies, eating the exact same food, moving around the exact same amount. So suddenly there was this realization that microbes contribute hugely to our ability to take in nutrients from our diets.
Mm.
And then that moved forward to, well, if they can do that, well, how do they affect
how
much we're taking in and what weight we end up. So the next step was to transfer microbes from lean people and obese people into germ-free mice and see what they did. And sure enough, the microbes coming from obese people made mice grow very fat very quickly. And the microbes coming from lean people had no impact. They just carried on being...
So you took microbes from people's guts, mm-hmm, and put those microbes into the guts of these mice that didn't,
yeah,
have any themselves.
Yeah, that's right.
A bit like a fecal transplant or something.
Yeah, kind of, except they gave them orally, poor little mice.
And then the ones that had the bacteria from the obese people, wow.
They rapidly grow fat, yeah, and get a much higher fat mass.
And do people know, have they looked into sort of which bacteria are the ones that seem to be making us fat?
Yeah, that seems to be far more complicated than you might imagine. So there are a few general rules, such as the higher diversity of microbes you have, the less likely you are to be fat. There's a few more about groups of bacteria, but I think they're slowly being unpicked.
Mm.
And then there's a couple of very specific bacteria that seem to be associated with being lean, and can be influenced and then seem to be able to promote leanness. So they're quite interesting.
That is fascinating. We're going to be talking a little bit more later how we might be able to cultivate the healthy bacteria, the lean bacteria for our guts. But I'm also really interested, I don't know much about this at all. How are they impacting our brain and our mental health?
Well, you have... One way is that there's a nerve that runs from your gut all the way to your brain. It's called the vagus nerve. And it's stimulated by the products that the microbes make. So some of these products are really similar to our neurotransmitters, which sounds mm-hmm. complicated, but it's actually stuff you've heard of, like serotonin and dopamine, all that kind of stuff. And so those compounds get released by the bacteria, if you've got those bacteria, and they stimulate that nerve, and that nerve makes you happy. It's kind of simple.
So you're almost having like the same chemicals from our brain are being created by these bacteria in our guts. Mm-hmm. And it's like a two-way process. Mm-hmm. Like that nerve is then taking those chemicals from our gut, feeding them back to our brain.
Yeah, and yeah, it is two-way as well. So when it's going back from the brain.
When you say like gut instinct and, you know, follow
Absolutely.
Your gut, maybe there's actually truth in that.
Yep.
That's
for sure.
Really cool. Oh, wow. Well, we've opened up this whole world, but we need to fit in the next song. Song number two, I believe, was going to be Casta Diva.
The Casta Diva, which is sung by Cecilia Bartoli, who's an Italian opera singer. It's from the opera Norma by Bellini. And I just love this song. It's just beautiful. It's one of those arias that everyone knows about. And it reminds me of my parents. My dad in particular is a huge opera fan. Just love to lie on the floor, listen to this, think about nothing.
Enough bacteria to fill up a small soup can.
Indeed you do. Now, this good bacteria, obviously, we sound like we want to be having a diverse gut bacteria and promoting the ones that are going to help make us lean. And I believe diet does actually, what we eat does affect which microbes live in our gut.
Yeah, it definitely does. It's one of the main things that affects it.
So how much truth is there in kind of having probiotics and fermented foods?
I think that there is. I personally take probiotics, so I've been convinced by all the research that I've read. I think particularly if you feel that there's something wrong with your gut bacteria, so if you have allergies or an autoimmune disease or something, then perhaps you'd be more inclined to take them. I think generally speaking, over our history, we would have been taking in much higher amounts of live bacteria through fermented foods, things like yogurt, sauerkraut, kefir in other countries. Every culture has their own kind of fermented food, because that's the way that food was stored in the past. Without refrigeration, you need to ferment it or cure it or pickle it or something along those lines.
And then those bacteria kind of keep it edible for you.
Exactly. And so then you're eating those bacteria, and that's stimulating your immune system in a different way.
Absolutely. Now, I know for some people, fermented food sounds a bit disgusting. They don't want to eat it. But luckily for you, we here on Science Mixtape have got a very kid-friendly even recipe of a fermented food you can make at home, or you can make right now with us. We are going to be making fermented ketchup. Now, Alana's looking a little bit sceptical. but we are going to start. So you want to take a container. I've just got like a very simple kind of glass clip jar that we are going to be using to ferment our ketchup in. And then the first thing you want is that you could make your own, but we are using tomato paste from a can. We've got about 3 cans of this. So if you could just start spooning that into the jar for me, please. Yep, nice pop there. Now, while she's doing that, I am going to be chopping up some garlic. This just gives flavour, it gives an extra source of fibre and nutrients, and all this tomato paste that's, you know, really condensed down. There's a lot of sugar in tomatoes. It's all going to be great food for the bacteria to grow in. And so, just a little bit of a chop. Now, once you've got all your tomato paste in, you need to add 3 tablespoons, of apple cider vinegar. And vinegar is just helping to make it nice and acidic, which are the conditions that the bacteria we want to have in our fermentation enjoy. So pickles, gherkins, sauerkraut, they all use vinegar as a pickling mixture. And that looks great, Alana, thank you. I'm going to get you to add the garlic. Have a little sniff. Oh,
that's pretty stinky.
We are smelling out Soho Radio. I do apologise, Tony Moore. I'm going to have to do this afterwards. Now, you could also make your own sauerkraut, but we are going to use the juice from some freshly bought sauerkraut. So I'm just going to ask you to pour that in there. And these are all your main ingredients, the tomato paste, the vinegar, and the sauerkraut juice. And that has already got some fermented bacteria in it. Thank you. So if we just give that a mix up, and then the only other things you need to add would be things to make it taste exactly how you want it to taste. So that would be salt, some chili pepper, we're just using a pinch of cayenne pepper, and then a spoonful or two of honey. Ideally, you want to leave about an inch of space below the top of your jar. And once you've got all of these things in your pot, you just mix them all up together. And you're going to leave it for about 3 days in its airtight container. You want to leave it for 24 hours at room temperature. Give that bacteria a nice head start to grow, because the optimum temperature for bacteria is about body temperature, 37 degrees. And then afterwards, once it seems fermented enough, you just store it in the fridge and you can keep it for months and have it as a little relish with your burgers, with your chips, or even sausages.
It does look quite tasty.
Now, we're not going to try this one yet because we haven't let it sit. But in true Blue Peter style, I have a little one that I made earlier.
Wow.
Alana, will you be my guest and have a little taste?
I will.
And if you could describe to the listeners what it tastes like, whether it's what you expected. If it's disgusting, I won't be offended.
Okay, here goes. It's actually pretty nice.
What flavours are you getting?
It's like a smoky tomato relish. Mm. It might be the cayenne pepper that's doing the work, but... I'll pretend it's the microbes. I could actually sit here and eat this whole jar.
Great. Well, there you go. So from the horse's mouth itself, it is delicious. You can make it. That was so quick, so easy. So whip that up at home, store it, and then immediately you're getting a little bit more live bacteria into your diet. Now, what are the other things that we should think about trying to eat to maintain a healthy gut bacteria?
So the biggest thing, probably I would say more important than probiotics or live bacteria, is fibre.
Oh, if anyone was listening and heard our question at the beginning, there was a clue. Why fibre?
So,
should we say, what is fibre? Sorry.
So first of all, fibre, kind of by definition, is food that doesn't get digested by our own digestive system in the small intestine, largely in the small intestine, and it moves all the way on to the large intestine where most of our microbes are sitting. So it's things that are, it's mostly carbohydrates, it's almost all carbohydrates, mm-hmm. and it's really complex ones.
And things we can't digest,
that we can't
it?
Break down easily because we don't have the enzymes for it. But microbes do have the enzymes for it, so they help us get more out of it. And also at the same time, we end up growing the microbes that do us good.
Is it like a food source for them then, because they can digest it?
Absolutely, yep. So that if they don't get fibre to eat, well, they will digest things like fats and proteins, but you'll get different ones because they're all specialised for a certain kind of food. So you'll end up growing a completely different community if you're eating a lot of fat and protein than if you're eating a lot of fibre or complex carbohydrates.
So that's really interesting. So different types of bacteria will feed off different foods.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why what we eat changes the amount of diverse bacteria we grow inside us.
Exactly. So you can actually change your bacteria within 24 hours by switching diet. You can have a huge impact.
Quickly?
Yeah, yeah. So if you switch back again, it will go back again. And it would probably take some time to really establish a set of bacteria that are fiber loving or a good diet rather than a high fat, high protein, high sugar diet. But yeah, it's very quick. I actually did an experiment myself using a microbe sequencing service called Ubiome, in which I ate loads more fibre than I normally would have done, and I kind of cut down a little bit on relatively fatty foods.
So what kind of foods were you eating to get that fibre?
So fibre comes from whole grains. So I switched to whole grain rice, whole grain bread, all that kind of thing. And it also comes from vegetables and fruits. So particularly high in fibre are the legumes, so beans and peas and lentils and so on. And so it's quite easy to switch, actually. It's, in fact, even if you just eat a half a cup of peas that you stick in the microwave for a couple of minutes with your lunch, even if you're having a sandwich.
You cook them in the microwave too?
Yeah.
My friends are going weird.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to cook them. Yeah, so easy. And then just to eat those, and you already have given yourself maybe 8 grams of fibre, which is probably half of what you're eating currently if you're not having a particularly high fibre diet. So it will add quite a lot. Breakfast cereals, proper ones like muesli, they have a lot of fibre in as well. So I did this experiment, ate loads more of that, and within 2 weeks of doing that, I sent off another sample, and I learnt that my microbes had indeed changed a lot, and I had 65 times the amount of this one bacteria that's particularly associated with leanness, which is called Akkermansia.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly I had all of this huge population of that bacteria which were making me more lean, shoring up my gut lining and stopping bad things from getting into my blood.
And the things that would be telling your body to store fat,
exactly.
Stopping them from getting through.
Yeah.
So there we go. All you need is some fermented ketchup and a lot of fibre. Coming on to our next song, I believe it's Forever Young by Jay-Z.
It is, yeah.
Why have you chosen this one?
It just makes me nostalgic for my 20s, now that I'm in my 30s. And I just feel like it just embodies something about youthfulness and hope.
It's one of my favourite songs as well. It's brilliant.
Three quarters of kids under 2 years have already had antibiotics.
Now, you talked a little bit about diet and how you can change your diet to help cultivate the right kind of bacteria. Mm-hmm. But there are actually a lot of other things that affect them, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So one of the things, as in the fact, is that if you have antibiotics, then that can significantly impact on the microbes you have. So there's a huge impact immediately, and it does actually persist for weeks, possibly months, possibly forever. It seems to be particularly important in young children that because their microbes are still establishing. So when you're born, you get a set of microbes that change over time, maybe about the first 3 years of your life. And then once you're on solid food like an adult, then you tend to have a fairly stable set of microbes, a generally stable set of microbes. So they're very changeable still, but it's the same kind of signature as an adult would have. And if it seems that the process of your immune system interacting with your microbes when you're very young has a particularly strong influence on your mental health, on your immune system, and on your tendency to gain weight. So people are particularly worried about children receiving a lot of antibiotics in early childhood. Obviously, antibiotics save lives. They still do that. And we have to use them when necessary, but we need to be much more cautious and understand that they have side effects and that they're not
desirable.
That we
may not all be aware of, yeah.
Yeah, so we've got a new trade-off now. It's not just about, oh, let's give them just in case. We have to pay attention to the fact that they could be doing damage.
As well.
Mm-hmm.
I also heard that whether you choose to have a natural birth or a cesarean can affect the bacteria in your newborn. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. So newborns, generally speaking, they get their bacteria from their mums on the way out. That's how they begin.
The vaginal wall.
Yeah, from the vaginal wall, and also a little bit of fecal matter. So the mums get their gut bacteria changes in the last trimester of pregnancy, and they get loads of lactobacillus, which is a lactic acid loving producing species. So it feeds on milk, and that's what babies feed on. So all the lactic acid bacteria in the vagina and a little bit in the feces goes into the baby's mouth, populates the baby's gut, and that's how it gets its good start in life, enabling it to break down milk. If you're born by C-section, if a baby comes out by C-section, then they don't encounter those microbes. They encounter microbes of the skin. They encounter the microbes on the hospital staff, in the hospital room. So they're much more likely to get a harmful infection on the way out. And they are also then prone to getting allergies and gastrointestinal infections, and are even more likely to become obese in later life because of that.
Really interesting. So do you think that like the modern increase we've seen in things like asthma might be down to our modern lifestyles impacting on what used to be our natural gut bacteria and is now changing?
I certainly think that it has an influence on it, and possibly a big influence.
And is there anything else? So we've got diet, we've got antibiotics, we've got the way you give birth.
Yeah, and then the other major one is breastfeeding. So breast milk provides a set of compounds that are specifically there to feed microbes. So they can't even be broken down by the baby's gut. They can only be broken down by the baby's microbes. And that produces all sorts of useful things for them. So it protects them against other pathogenic disease-causing microbes coming in and making them sick. And it encourages their immune system to tolerate the right things and not tolerate the wrong things. And it encourages this particularly niche set of microbes that you really want in a young child. Whereas formula, good though it may be for keeping babies alive when their mums can't give them milk, doesn't provide that very selective group of microbes and doesn't do quite as good a job. And again, formula feeding is associated with a higher risk of allergies, autoimmunity, obesity, and so on.
So, and I guess that's not surprising. I mean, natural breastfeeding and natural birth, that's how we've done things for thousands of years, and our new techniques have only been so recent.
Yeah, absolutely. We've evolved with these microbes forever. So it's not surprising that the system is quite well honed. And most formula milks come from a base of cow's milk. And cows have quite a different digestive system. They have quite different brains.
They have four stomachs.
Yeah, exactly. So their milk is perfect for their babies, and our milk is perfect for our babies. And we need to adjust formula so that it's the best it can be.
And you're actually pregnant yourself, and you're saying that your hormones might be having an effect on your gut bacteria.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm currently 5 months pregnant, and
congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. And I am particularly interested at the moment, obviously, in what my microbes are doing. And there's some really interesting research that suggests that in the third trimester of pregnancy, your microbes shift to being a community that's much more similar to those of an obese person. And that creates in your body a tendency towards a bigger appetite, towards insulin insensitivity. So that's a kind of precursor for type 2 diabetes. And basically it makes your body store fat, and it makes you want to eat more.
Which obviously makes sense, because you're going to have to be feeding this baby, and you need to be piling on your reserves.
Yeah, so women, not only do they get the weight of the baby and the placenta and so on, but they also put on more fat reserves during late pregnancy.
And that is fascinating, that the bacteria become similar to those of an obese person.
Yeah, so that's the one, possibly one of the major mechanisms that helps you to gain weight as a pregnant woman in preparation for breastfeeding.
Wow. But once you are born, so that's quite a lot around your birth, which obviously we have no control over if we're the baby. Mm-hmm. Once you are born, it's just about staying away from antibiotics unless absolutely necessary, and eating lots of fibre.
Exactly, yeah.
Brilliant. On to song 4, Viva La Vida by Coldplay.
Yeah.
Tell me about this one.
I just find it so uplifting. Again, it has to do with my wedding. This was the song we walked back up the aisle to together. I kind of also love it because it's got church bells in it, and I didn't get married in a church, so it was nice to have the kind of traditional church bells in
the
background.
Where did you get married?
I got married in the garden of a big house in East Sussex.
Lovely. Oh, well, let's dedicate this one to your husband.
Yeah.
have around 21,000 genes, but the microbes carry 5 to 10 million genes.
News. Researchers break record for keeping lab-grown human embryos alive.
Dolphins have been observed chatting to each other to help with problem-solving tasks.
And a new study shows that one in four people on New York subways have fecal matter on their hands. Science. That is fascinating. Lab-grown human embryos.
Yep. So they've been doing it for a while, and they tend to only get the embryos to about 7 days, maybe 9 days is the limit. And the reason they do it is because they're investigating things like whether we can use stem cells to cure horrible diseases, and also to try to understand the process that the tiny embryo undergoes when it implants into the uterus lining, which is the point that pregnancy sort of
begins.
Really kicks off.
Yeah.
So it's got to the point now where the science is enabling scientists to keep embryos going for 13 days or more. And so it's not long before they break this sort of arbitrary limit that was set about 30 years ago, of that we shouldn't grow embryos past 14 days, because then we get into all these ethical discussions of what are you doing with a human embryo that's starting to turn into a human-like form, and then you have to ditch it, which is probably morally wrong. So it's kind of interesting to me because, like many women, I had a number of miscarriages very early in my case, fortunately for my sanity. And the problem seemed to be that my uterus was happily accepting these embryos, even though they weren't particularly good quality in
a
biological sense. And so then it was having to reject them later after I already knew I was pregnant. So I'm quite interested in it because I also know lots of other people who have had miscarriages and even later. And that means that if we were allowed to keep embryos for longer, scientists could do the research to try to understand why some people are having later miscarriages and what exactly is going on. Is it a natural process, or is it something that we could help them to keep their babies?
From the environment or something, yeah. It is a tricky ethical one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess if people are given permission to donate those embryos, but... yeah, is it their choice or is it the embryo's choice?
Yeah, that's a good point. They do tend to be donated embryos from IVF cycles that people didn't end up needing to use.
Yeah.
But yeah, if personal wishes come into it as well, then that makes it even more complicated.
Tell me more about the dolphins, Lou.
Well, six dolphins were tested with a tricky puzzle. Most struggle with the puzzle. However, there were two dolphins who solved the puzzle in just 30 seconds, which is pretty impressive for a pair of dolphins. And turns out when the experimenters were listening back to the study, they heard that the dolphins had been communicating with each other and that they'd used this communication to help solve the puzzle. And another way that they were certain that it definitely was the communication that helped is that one other dolphin actually did solve the puzzle, but he took so much longer and he did it by himself and he wasn't communicating. And I just think that's like literally crazy that there's dolphins out there in the ocean solving puzzles, chatting away.
Yeah, that's taking their intelligence to a whole new level.
Yeah, honestly, I had no idea. I'm pretty curious to find out if there's any more studies out there with animals chatting to each other to solve problems. Maybe they'll be on the next university challenge or something, the animal special.
And then finally, the study in the New York subway, microbe-related, and it is quite interesting. So they swabbed all these people's hands and they swabbed all these areas on the tube and found a phenomenal number of bacteria. They discovered four new species they didn't know before. They found anthrax, they found the bacteria responsible for the bubonic plague, and they found that one in four people had fecal matter on their hands, which is pretty disgusting. But it all sounds very scary and scaremongering. Actually, you know, the fact that these bacteria are there all the time, clearly we are fine and our immune systems are doing a good job. So rather than freaking out because there's anthrax on the tube, be like, great, my body can fight it. And I guess just be careful whose hand you shake after a subway ride. That is the end of the science news for this week. Alana, your fifth song is 22nd Century by Kellis. Why have you chosen that one today?
I wouldn't say this was one of my favourite songs in the world ever, but I do love this album for writing to. I don't know why, but I like to write to dance music. It kind of gets me in the zone and makes me concentrate. So this is just one of the songs from that album. Welcome to the place.
Than cells in our body.
Now, Lana, you were saying just before this, that was the song that you like to write to. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you about that, actually. I mean, writing a whole book seems so daunting. How did you approach it? I think all writers have their own little ways.
Oh, gosh, it's just a mental effort every day. I can't say I find it particularly easy, but I do kind of love it. Once I get going, I don't know.
It's like the process is horrible, but yeah, the pride with the finished product is worth it.
Yeah, the process when you know what you're writing about and you kind of get into a flow, then it feels amazing. It feels like you're filled with endorphins or something. But
like
yeah,
mental exercise.
Yeah, it is pretty hard. I always liken it, without trying to be too pretentious about it, to a kind of performance that you've got to get into your voice every day. And you know, I just have my breakfast downstairs with my cats and then walk upstairs into my office, and then suddenly I've got to perform, and I find that very difficult. So
yeah, you've got to get in the zone.
You've somehow got to warm yourself up and feel like writing and get on with it. So I also had quite a short deadline, so I was having to write a certain number of words a day. Well, it sounds like not very many, especially to any fiction writers out there, but 500 a day was what I had to achieve. But that was with all the
fact checking,
research and fact checking and so on. Yeah, so it does take a while.
Yeah, gosh. And you're writing a new book right now, aren't you?
I am, yeah. I'm just at the beginning of writing my second book, which is tentatively called Fatology. I got so interested in the obesity thing because, like most people, I thought that people gained weight because they ate too much and they didn't exercise enough.
Yeah.
And then you hear the story that microbes transferred from an obese person into a mouse can make the mouse fat, even though the mouse doesn't eat any differently or exercise any differently. And you think, well, hang on a second. There's obviously more to it than what we're traditionally told. And I spoke to a number of scientists, and a lot of them gave me the impression that they thought that, yes, it's because we eat too much and we move too little, but that there's biological reasons behind that. People are following their appetites. They're following in their appetites to drink loads of sugary drinks, for example. And why? Why do they want to drink sugary drinks? And it turns out that there are all sorts of other environmental reasons why your appetite might be skewed, why you might be putting down more fat than you should be.
Really?
So for example, as we were talking about the antibiotics in early childhood, or not being breastfed, those definitely have an impact on your propensity to gain weight. And then there's all sorts of other things like environmental chemicals that we encounter that actually interfere with our hormone systems. So there are very many of them potential candidates for causing these kinds of problems. But for example, there are some compounds in food packaging that leach into the food and could be having this kind of impact. There's air pollution that could be having that kind of impact.
And is this directly on us? Is it quite a quick impact?
It seems to be most prominent when a baby is in the uterus or in very early childhood that it's having these kind of impacts. And it seems to be switching the hormone systems that control your body's production of fat and your appetite into ones that you're directing more of the energy you take in into fat storage, which is leaving you, the rest of your body, feeling a little hungry. So you end up eating more.
So, I mean, could you, if you were feeling a bit like you were overweight, could you turn around and be like, "Mum, it's your fault. You ate the wrong thing."
That would be
we're
me.
Exposed to the wrong
yes.
things.
Quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And you just have to be extra vigilant, I suppose, when you are pregnant. We talked a little bit right at the beginning. I'm just conscious of time. You did mention that you were a zoologist and worked in bats.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit more about that, because that's completely different.
Yeah, it is. It is very different. I started out, I just became particularly interested in bats when I was about 18. And throughout my degree and my master's, did bat stuff. And then I did a PhD on the evolutionary biology of bats. So I spent a lot of time, I've spent loads of time abroad in jungles and deserts and so on, catching bats and recording their echolocation calls, their ultrasonic calls that they use to find their way around. Yeah, so that used to be my career, and I'm quite glad to be a bit more stationary now than that.
And what were you sort of looking for in their echolocation calls?
I was trying to figure out how they switched from using vision to using echolocation. And they all make different calls, so you can kind of put those calls across a family tree of all the bats and then trace them back step by step to try and understand what the first ever bat call would have been like.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Oh, this is the perfect time for us to segue into...
Fieldwork Faux Pas.
This is a little feature we like to do with all our scientists. And so what do you think would be one of your biggest fieldwork faux pas while you were out tracking the bats?
Well, the ultimate... I mean... Gosh, mine aren't funny, they're just sad, I realised. But my ultimate one is walking through a tick nest, getting bitten by 50 ticks and then developing Lyme disease. But
although you wouldn't be here if that hadn't happened.
That's true, yeah. It did stimulate the idea lining. For the book. But, oh gosh, loads of them. I've been in a huge bat cave that's just got absolutely mounds of maybe 2 metre deep bat poo that's built up over the centuries, probably. And I've managed to trip over whilst holding loads of bat detector equipment that I needed to not go in the bat poo, so I went face first into that instead.
Oh my God, did you sink like the whole way through the 2 metres?
It's a bit like... it's a bit like snow. You fall, you sink just a little bit, and then it compacts and stops you. What else? Ooh. Oh, I've taken a...
Maybe you picked up some good bacteria from
that
then.
Yeah, probably not. I think I was lucky not to get some bad stuff from that.
Today has been fascinating. Thank you so much. Where can people get your book if they are interested in finding out more?
They can get it in any bookshop and on Amazon. It's called 10% Human, How Your Body's Microbes Hold the Key to Health and Happiness. It's just came out in paperback on Thursday, so it's now a little bit cheaper, and it's got a nice new cover.
It looks really cool. I urge all our listeners, it really is a fascinating read. And very quickly, we need to give the answer to our brain teaser. Have we had anyone tweeting in?
We've had a couple, yes. Some people have guessed, I mean, they've obviously not listened properly, and they've said probiotics.
That's half right.
And then a lot of people have gone for like legumes, sort of salads. Yep. And we've had one correct answer, which was fibre, which was from Abby Dawson.
Congratulations, Abby. Fibre it was. Alana, your final song is Wicked Games. Tell me about that choice.
This is just another kind of writing song that I like, and it just takes you to another place. It's got an amazing tune to it.
Lovely. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.